Karma Hadaven.
What's up, Kevin? Koval.
How are you?
It's been a long life.
Indeed. Indeed it has. We've done many things in these last few days, man.
Yes.
And so many things to come.
Yeah.
Yeah. Are you, you know, just, I want to remind people that the social media handle is at Corner Store Pod. Wait,
no.
What the fuck is it? It's at Corner Store underscore pod.
Yeah.
At Corner Store underscore pod.
Twitter, SoundCloud, which I need to update. Yeah.
Yeah, but it's good. I like when people rock with us in those spaces. Cause,
just broke 1,000 followers on Instagram.
So get at us. Get at us. Yeah. And make sure, you know, it's nice too. I've been, when people are leaving comments on the iTunes page and everything like that, you know, rate, subscribe, leave comments, you know, talk about episodes you like and let us know what you like and even maybe let us know who you would like to hear from. We have an incredible guest with us tonight.
We do.
This is a writer and someone who is really part of the family at this point. Tara and I had the great occasion to spend a little bit of time over the ocean with her. This is someone who is not only very serious with the pen, the author of the award-winning collection, The January Children, the author of editor of the forthcoming anthology, Halal, If You Hear Me, which is the third in the Breakbeat Poets series. Lives in Washington, D.C., summers in Chicago via the Sudan. One of our favorites is in the Corner Store with us, Safia El Hilo. Safia, hello.
Hello, my friends.
Welcome to the Corner Store and to Chicago.
Thank you for having me. Can you still say welcome to Chicago if I half live here?
Well, look.
You really half live here?
Not really. I've been here for like a week every summer. Does that count? I summer here.
Two weeks this summer.
Yeah,
and we're, you know, look, this is the long con. You know what I mean? It's like start off with a weekend and then became a week. Yeah,
apparently.
Tara, why you
why? Dicey.
Yeah,
yeah. We're gonna talk about it. We're gonna talk about it.
I mean, but you're in DC, so
DC is different. It's humane in the winter there. It's different
is
here.
It?
Yeah.
I mean, I've been in when I was in New York in the winter. It was pretty brutal sometimes.
It was pretty brutal, but this also. I came here in February once, and I've been traumatized ever since.
You shrivel up into a raisin.
Yeah, everything hurts.
And and you don't come out of it until like April.
Yeah, I'm not built for that.
No,
but that's why there's Uniqlo. Anyway, an aspirational sponsor.
Also leaving in the winter, but anyway.
Oh, also true. Yeah. Yeah, true. That's why,
right.
You know.
Started summering in Chicago. I might move up to wintering elsewhere.
That is the dream. That is the Chicago dream, really. The Chicago dream is like a bungalow and eventually leaving in the winter.
Yeah.
Yeah. LA. Yeah. Winter. Yeah. Or for the Jews, Florida. But either way. That's true.
Offerings?
Yeah, true. Facts.
For Safia.
Yes, we do. Safia, sorry. Before
like,
we...
True.
Before
are
we...
Yeah.
I'm like, yeah, housing? I didn't know what we were talking about.
I thought he was going to offer me like a health insurance plan or something.
Soon come.
Can I get dental? Can I get LASIK?
We have some treats for you. This was because,
ooh.
You know, we spent some time in Paris, so I got you a sparkling French lemonade.
I feel automatically fancier. Thank you.
Yeah. No, I thought that would be.
What that bag was. I thought you brought lunch.
Yeah, I thought that'd be good. These are your snacks. Also, because you know you're fancy, so triple chocolate toffee.
Ooh.
And I think it's also a French brand. So anyway,
where the hell did you go, France?
Right.
Yep. Yeah. Listen, you know, carry snacks wherever I go, and this is because you are in the greatest city in the world, and one of the esteemed snacks is the Chicago mix, caramel and cheddar popcorn. So
you know,
that's also
I've heard
for you.
Tell, and I've never tried this before.
Yo. Yeah.
Oh, you haven't?
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
It's good.
Yeah. But
I favor the caramel to the cheddar because when you know I usually run out of caramel at the end, but it's also fire.
So do you eat them both together or do you alternate?
Yeah.
No, yeah, it's not like Crunch Berries and the Captain Crunch.
Sweet berry.
Exactly.
Well, thank you for my dinner. You got all the food groups.
Good. Well, enjoy. And you please feel free to enjoy now if you wish, although you are wearing a lovely fit.
The microphone?
No, you can. We like sound effects. but I don't want you to get the cheddar dust all over your
Is it like
fit.
A Cheetos situation where maybe I'll drink this clear French lemonade that has no color?
Yeah. I hope you enjoy that.
Lemonade. Quote unquote.
Yeah, I don't know what it is. It's French.
Essence of lemon.
Exactly.
Water. I'll let you capitalize on like infused water situation.
Yeah, they probably rubbed the lemon peel on this bottle before they poured the water in.
Fine, you're white, so
I'll
just say
y'all. I know, I'm just saying, but you're like dead in the eye. You're like, you, when you profited off of this particular beverage, I know.
Y'all, you're
cucumber. Which I got to be honest, that it is really delicious.
I do like a cucumber water.
Yeah, cucumber water for the people.
I put the cucumber in my cup.
Like an actual cucumber?
Oh, no, you're not supposed to see it. You're supposed to like know it was there.
In the jug. Like, I'm not going to eat that. You just wasted like a slice. Like, how many slices of cucumber y'all waste?
Damn.
Look, I that also hits close to home because my people love to pickle cucumbers. So anyway, you know, you don't want them to go to waste.
I also come from the pickling people.
Right, yeah, true. Speaking of, Safia, hey.
Three representatives of the pickling people in the studio right now.
So we want to talk about so many things, and we want you know, to know about you and kind of where you come from and everything like this, and get to what you're working on. But if we were to take it all the way back, where is a young Safia born and raised? I know that's a complicated question.
Well, born is an easy one. I was born in Rockville, Maryland, which is obviously the most exciting part of the whole story.
Yeah.
You know, and Rockville looks like every other suburb in the country, and that there's like a Chili's, a Toys R Us, and like lots of highway. But my family was living in Maryland at the time, and that's how I came up on this young American passport also.
Right.
I was raised a lot of places. So born in Maryland, my family moved to Kenya for a second and then moved back to Maryland. My brother was born. It's also his 24th birthday today.
Oh, right. So yeah. Happy birthday.
24 years ago on this day, a second El Hilo was born in Rockville, Maryland. And then we moved to Tanzania. And then from there, moved to Egypt and then to England and then to Switzerland, and then moved to D.C. in 2000 or 2001.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was there all through the rest of my grammar schooling, and then I moved to New York in 2009.
The city?
Yes. And then I went to college there.
Oh,
so I was like, I had agency at that point. It wasn't just other people moving me around.
Yeah, yeah. I was like, damn. you have an interesting accent, but anyway.
It's many, many things.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like general Northeastern and also ethnic.
Yeah.
So I lived in New York for 6 years, like to the day. And then I've been based back in DC for, it'll be 3 years on September 1st.
Mm.
But I've been, mostly touring since then, so I don't know that I technically live in DC. I get mail in DC.
Right. Yeah, I think that counts.
Technicality.
Yeah.
I feel like. Is this because of your parents' work that you?
Which part? Well, yeah. So the first half of it, my dad, when I was growing up, worked for the UN's High Commission for Refugees.
Oh, okay.
So he would be in the field in whatever place was popping off at the time. And, you know, Africa in the early 90s, you could just like spit and you would hit war zone.
Yeah.
And they would move my mom and the kids to whatever was nearby and safe. So when we were in Kenya and Tanzania, I believe he was working in Somalia. When we were in... So Egypt was different because my grandparents were living there at the time, and my dad was based in Liberia, so my mom was like, let me go hang out with my parents since, you know, you're doing your own thing anyway. England was because my mom was going to grad school. Switzerland was, I think the UN, like the big head office is there, so my dad was trying his hand at doing the desk job thing for a year. Mm. And then we moved to the U.S. because my mom got a job. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well, what does that do to you as a young person? How much of that moving around do you remember as a kid, and how much of that, I mean...
Does it affect you?
Yeah. Because that's a ton of moving, I feel like. And
well, I think it's hard to remember something if it doesn't register as that. You know, so there wasn't any example of anything other than how we were living, so I just thought it was what people did, so... Mm-hmm. It didn't strike me as like strange in any way or something to be like worth noting in any way in that sense, where I was just like, well, all right, this is my family and this is what we do. I'm a little mad that I was too young to remember all these like probably cool places. And I now, as an adult, I'm very good at packing.
True. Very That's concise.
Yep. I remember in when we were in London, you had the smallest bag for like a month of travel or something.
Exactly.
And I was like, shit.
It's my favorite. I'm also very good at Tetris, and I think the two skills are related.
Right, blocks, I guess. Do you roll your clothes, or do you put them in like those cubicle things?
I roll my clothes. I bought those little cubes, but I feel like they make my bag heavy. So every time I'm like, I'm going to become a person who uses packing cubes, and then I'll pack my whole bag and be like, this is... I don't carry this. This is heavy.
Yeah.
But usually I'll do... I mostly roll, but anything long, like pants or a dress or a jumpsuit, I lay flat, and then I put the rolled stuff, and then I fold it over the top. Mm. Your hip.
Tactics. I know. I feel you.
I feel like so much of my personhood is tied to place, you know? And
Chicago Nationalist Kevin Colville.
Right. And being a kid, too, like, rooting for the Bulls and just... wanting to like and like loving certain sights and shit like that, like what did you kind of begin to anchor your identities to as a young person, I guess, like who in all of that movement, you know, was it family, was it religion, you know, what were some of the things that were, you know, anchoring just, you know, the early conception of who you thought yourself to be?
Well, I think lack of place has been sort of the nucleus of it for a very long time. But, I mean, the main thing that I've always identified as is Sudanese. But that was always, it's been an abstraction my whole life. You know, it's not, I don't know that I identify necessarily as a person who is from Sudan, because I've never lived in Sudan. But Sudanese-ness as like a greater, like, cultural, linguistic attitude always felt like the closest thing to like a place that I was from, even when it wasn't a place. And that was the constant everywhere. You know what I mean? It, like, we moved to all these places, yes, but the house always looked and smelled the exact same no matter where we were. And so the one constant in my life was that I was in a Sudanese household, no matter what country I was in. And it came with all, you know, the rules and the curfews accordingly. But that was a real anchor. And my mom made sure pretty early on that my brother and I were speaking Arabic in the house. I didn't get good at English really until very late in the game, because my mom wanted to make sure we didn't lose our Arabic. And I think that made it so that it was, I never had a question about my identity in that way. I think all of my questions about identity are about geography, actually, not about, I know who I am, I just don't know where I'm from.
Right, right. And your grandparents are, you have grandparents still in the Sudan?
Oh, both sets are in Sudan.
Right.
Yeah, well, my maternal grandparents are currently summering in D.C. at the moment, but they're, like, very much live in Sudan.
And although you've never lived there yourself, you've been...
So I'm surprised you haven't.
A bunch, though.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think the thing is, it was always... You know, in between moves, we'd usually go chill in Sudan for a little bit, too. I think the reason I say I never lived in Sudan is because I never went to school in Sudan. And that was always, like, so much of a part of moving to a new place was starting a new school there. Even, like, this move back to D.C. 3 years ago was the first time I'd moved to a city and didn't start school there right after I'd moved. So I think I feel very much connected to being in Sudan, because it was, like, you know, I'd been going there my whole life. I would, like... spend whole summers there and hang out with my cousins who lived in other countries who I never got to see. Mm-hmm. I would spend time with my grandparents who I otherwise never got to see. Yeah.
Immigrant abroad.
Yeah, it's like the same diasporic story everywhere, you know?
Yeah. That Sudanese home, what was the music and what was the, I guess just start there. Because I know music also plays so heavily in your own verse and your own writing and your own focus. What was some of the consistent sounds in the space?
Well, so my, it depends on who was DJing.
Always does.
My grandma listens to a lot of like golden age Arab pop music. So a lot of the stuff at, in like the 40s, 50s, 60s was coming out of Egypt for the most part. But there was also here and there you would hear like a Lebanese singer who was very famous. But Abdel Halim Hafez, who's like the central conceit of the whole book, you know, was my grandmother's contribution to my life, where it was just very much like a, I didn't even register it as music for a long time. It was just sort of like the background thing that was happening.
Hmm.
My parents' taste was a lot more eclectic, but I think it was because they, my grandparents, I think, were the last people in my family who were like Sudanese and from Sudan, without question. My mom was also like fairly diasporic in her upbringing and lived everywhere and also has like, you know, this like combination accent where she'll like randomly say thank you in a British accent, but everything else is very American. And she, you know, she listens to a little bit of everything. I, you know, I love Celine Dion because my mom loves Celine Dion. She would play a lot of Celine Dion's French language stuff. I don't really speak French, but I know a bop when I hear it. We would, I think this was my dad's contribution. He used to get these compilation CDs of, you know, it would go under like the world music category, but it was just usually music from all over Africa, and it was called Spirits of Nature. So you'd have stuff like, you know, like Rai from Algeria, and then you'd have like Brenda Fassie from South Africa. We would listen to a lot of her growing up, like Ethiopian jazz, all this, you know. So I grew up listening to a whole lot of everything,
yeah,
for the most part.
And
my grandpa would mostly listen to, it's called Madih, and it's a cappella. I think it might be improvised. I hope I'm not making that up. But it's poetry that is sung, and it's praise music, where it's all like lyric praising the Prophet Muhammad. But there's like a cadence and a rasp to it that's like profoundly Sudanese. And it's, I very much associate it with like the stuff my grandpa would listen to when he would have whatever the equivalent of the aux cord was at the time.
Where does language, is that where language kind of begins to occupy a space for you? I mean, did you come from storytellers? When did you feel like you also were getting that penchant for storytelling or for writing? Or
not for a long time. So I very much do come from storytellers. My grandpa is a poet, my maternal grandpa, and he's writing like a hybrid genre memoir right now, where it's like, because, you know, Sudan as a sovereign state is like fairly young, so he's been alive since before Sudan was an independent state. So he's like remembering a lot, and, you know, he like lived to see the country as it is today, like form and fall apart. So he's thinking a lot about that stuff. But he also, in addition to being a poet, he's just such a student of it, and he is of that generation where you memorize everything. So he like has poems that he was taught in elementary school that he still has memorized verbatim. So a lot of the, I don't know how, you know, copyright's gonna work, but a lot of the book is also like he'll like remember a poem by I don't even know who, and then we'll like write it down and it's in the manuscript.
He's sampling.
Yeah.
You know?
So he's very much, and he, like, he's a very social man also, in that there's, he's so in his element when he's, like, in the middle of a group of people and he's, like, telling a funny story and everyone is, like, hanging on to his every word. My grandma is also very much a storyteller, and she also has the most incredible memory. So she knows everyone's first and last name, whose daughter they are, who's what, like, greater family they come from, how they're related to so-and-so and ultimately related to us, and can do that, like, she doesn't have to stop and think about it.
Damn.
And so, which is to say that she, like, knows everything about everyone. So they both are, like, storytellers in that there's craft to it, but it's also a way that they socialize. My aunt writes poetry, writes plays, she's a photographer, she's a filmmaker. So she was the artist of the family who was the first one who, like, pursued it as a job. Because my grandfather is a poet, yes, but he also, like, you know, worked for the IMF for most of his life. So that wasn't what he was doing 9 to 5, is writing poetry. So my aunt was the one who was, like, she was the first one to get an MFA, and she got fellowships, and she, you know what I mean? So
how did that take with the family, given that there's art in the family, but they have also, you know, traditional gigs, I guess.
They're very chill about it, I think, for the most part. I also, I've never heard anyone say this. I might be imposing this on them, but I suspect it's gendered too, where because maybe when she was younger, the thought wasn't that she was going to have to be the breadwinner for anyone. They'd be like, okay, like, write your poems, and then, you know, someone else will make sure that the mortgage is paid. Right.
So when you came along and did your thing, they were...
I'm not doing anything new. They're like, oh, that again?
Yeah. That's great. That's so nice. Yeah, yeah, your aunt kind of helped to pave like the way for you. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And you're cool with her?
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, she's the one who low-key made all this possible. Yeah.
Wow, that's really dope. So you said it came later for you, though, the writing for you came later. When did it begin to, when did you know, when did it begin to bubble in your head that this is something that you thought about, even the possibility of pursuing?
So, I don't think I'd even written anything that wasn't for a school assignment until I was in high school, I think. So as a younger child, I was always making something because I also, my mom, my entire childhood would never let my brother and I say that we were bored. Whenever one of us said I'm bored, she would go make us like write a book report or clean our room or something. So you learn not to say bored.
Yeah.
But I was always making, I was like, you know, like drawing a picture and making, like sewing clothes for my dolls or whatever. So when the poetry came along, I would like be really into something and then would like drop it 3 months later. So I thought it was just going to be that again. I thought it was going to go the way of the violin and the flute and the painting and whatever else I'd been into up until that point. But in my sophomore year of high school, I joined the DC Youth Slam team because I'd been going to Busboys and Poets in DC because it was something to do. And then I ended up finding this really wild and beautiful community through the slam team in a way that I didn't really have before because I was kind of, you know, I'm a little bit of a hermit, and I, you know, when given a choice between, like, going out and building meaningful bonds with people my own age or, like, rereading the entire Harry Potter series, you already know which one I was going to choose. And then suddenly I joined the slam team, and I was, like, with this, like, tribe of weirdos, and I never wanted to go home.
You met them via Busboys and Poets? That's where they were having their open mic. Busboys, you know, Busboys. Yeah. Busboys and Poets is also an incredible space.
Yeah.
Yeah, they have many,
they
many.
They have, like, it's a franchise now. There's, like, six of them.
Really?
Yeah.
DC?
Mm-hmm. DC, and now there's one in Maryland.
Maryland, yeah.
It's like the New Yorkan or whatever. What's the thing?
The New Yorkan.
New Yorkan?
Yeah. But it has, yeah, it's a bookstore, and it has a restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
It has performance spaces. Yeah. I think in each of the spaces, but
yeah,
the first one was all off of U Street, 14th and V.
Yeah.
It's just a, you know, they really call together a lot of communities, I feel like. I'm very fond of that space, and that's where they would have an open mic there, and you met these band of weirdos.
Yeah,
there.
Well, so the Tuesday night open mic, the thing about it is that it was on a school night and it didn't start until 9. So the rule, my mom was like, yeah, you can go, but we all have to come with you. And we, at the time, because also, you know, we were sort of like the American outpost of the family. So whoever wanted to, like, send their kid over to go to school or whatever, most likely that person, that cousin or uncle or whoever was living with us. So,
oh, y'all rolled deep.
Oh, yeah.
No, that's not far enough.
Exactly.
And bring then the squad.
The first couple times we tried to go, it used to sell out pretty quickly. And we'd roll up and there'd be like 9 of us. And they'd be like, sorry, guys, we don't have space for all of you. Try and come back earlier next week.
Mm-hmm.
So eventually, after trying like 3-4 times, they finally let all 13 of us in or whatever. And they all like arranged themselves in the first row.
And staring at you while
you're
born. Are you saying some shit about them, though?
Or? No, I knew better at the time.
I wish you had your wits about you.
Yeah. And that's how it was for a while. I would go to these open mics under the condition that my entire family had to come with me.
That's wild.
That's amazing.
That's cool, though. They're part of it.
Yeah.
They want to be part of it.
No, they're always very supportive about it, which was cool.
Yeah.
And which
you
I
don't get that a lot.
Yeah, I didn't realize until afterwards where I started meeting other people who were doing it, that, like how wild and lucky it was.
Yeah.
That's true. Yeah. So you met the folks, you met the other youth poets at the time in D.C.?
I don't remember exactly how I ended up at the tryout for the team, because it wasn't at Busboys. It was in the auditorium of a high school. I think I thought it was another open mic. I didn't know what slam was. So I went to what I thought was this open mic, but it was a 2-round slam and I only brought one poem. So then I like quickly had to like figure out something. And this was also, you know, in my analog days, so I had a notebook. So yeah. I could just like flip through the notebook and find something else to read. And I ended up making the team. But this was, it was 2008. And the DC Slam team, it's under Split This Rock now, but it wasn't at the time. I think the organization was called Soli Soul and the funding was not so much. So it was a very like scrappy DIY situation where I don't think it was until like a couple BNVs that like, you know, we weren't raising money for plane tickets the day before we flew out.
Yeah. And you in high school too, also hip hop played a prominent role in your development, I mean, in your tastes, in your life.
Yes.
When did that come into the mix too?
So there were sort of two creation myths, I guess. Or I guess the two times that I feel like I met hip hop, the first, I was much younger the first time. I was living in Egypt in an apartment with, again, like my grandparents, my mom, an aunt and uncle. And my uncle's room was always off limits. It was always, he was a college student at the time. So there were always like young hip people and the smell of cigarettes coming out of that room and we were not allowed inside. And then I remember one day I was sent in to like give him something or call him for something or whatever. And he had a TV in the room and I walked in and I remember the video for, it was right after Biggie died and the video for, Diddy and Faith Evans, I'll Be Missing You was on. I had never seen anything like that, never heard anything like that before in my life because I wasn't really, I don't think at that age I was choosing much of the music I was listening to. I was kind of just listening to whatever the adults were playing. And then, you know, he would like sometimes let me come in and hang out in his room and play a computer game or something and he would usually be listening to, he listened to a lot of Biggie, he listened to a lot of Wu-Tang. It like started to absorb at the time, but I wasn't really thinking anything of it.
You're also pretty young at the time.
Yeah. Right? Yeah, I didn't know what was going on. I just knew it was hot.
Right.
And then in middle school, so my mom used to travel a lot for work. And so she got me an emergency cell phone that was just for if, you know, because my brother and I used to take public transportation home. So if it was like, if anything happens, this is the cell phone for that. This is not like for texting your little friends. But also at that age, not a whole lot of people had cell phones. So I didn't really have anyone to be on the phone with in the first place. And my friend at the time, I was friends with this dude and he wanted to talk to this girl, but he didn't want to use the house phone because his mom had a lot of rules around the house phone. So he was like, all right, I have a proposition for you. If you let me borrow your cell phone for the night, I'll let you borrow my entire CD case. I was like, that sounds
not bad.
All right. I was like, you know, okay, free minutes
CD
start
Logic,
after 9.
Like a big, like the big CD Logic
joint. It was
joint.
Enormous.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay. And I also, you know, he knew the rules. He knew to only talk on the phone once my free hours started, my free minutes started at 9.
Right.
So they clocked on the bill, though?
They clocked on the bill, but I explained the situation to my mom, and she's very cool about it.
Oh, okay.
Not till later, because it wasn't until... Well, because I was too young at the time for her to think that I was using the phone for anything, especially when nothing was showing up on the bill as money. Yeah. It was later on when I started going to youth poetry slams and like making friends with people from all over the country, she would go through my phone bill with a highlighter and be like, who do you know in Texas?
Wow.
But these were simpler times.
Yeah, right.
So I borrowed this CD case overnight and there were all sorts of things in there.
What's your favorite? What were you drawn to?
It was the first time I heard 36 Chambers. And I recognized it because I remembered hearing it. When I would like go hang out with my uncle, but again, I didn't know what it was called. I didn't know who those people were. I didn't know what the song was. So I was like, wow, this sounds, I know this and I don't know where I know it from. That was in there. There were a lot of like one hit wonder full albums. Like, you remember Houston, the R&B singer? Yeah, I have the Houston album in my iTunes to this day because of that CD case. What else was in there? But he also listened to, again, we were in the seventh grade. He was listening to a lot of like weird shit for a seventh grader. There was like, he was listening to like Del the Funky Homo Sapien. He was listening to Binary Star. He was listening to Planet Asia. So I also like, as like a 13-year-old, suddenly had all of this stuff to listen to. So it was like a very thorough and expansive education.
Yeah.
Your parents didn't care what you listened to.
They didn't really know what I was listening to. You know, the.
But once you explained the trade-off, she wasn't like.
No, she wasn't like, what was in there, you know? My mom was busy. She had to go to work. She wasn't like.
I mean, she's highlighting your phone bill, so I don't know.
Again, a simpler time.
Yeah.
I think later on when I was like 16 and wearing tighter jeans, she was like, what is going on?
Yeah.
Let me look at the phone bill.
Yeah. You got an ass now? Okay.
Now let me start looking.
Okay. Well, that's a treasure trove. And I mean, we could fast forward a little bit, but, you know, one of the first. Times, Angel Nafis put me onto you when you had
shout out Angel Nafis
always every day of my life. When Safia's, you know, your first collection, I guess chapbook. It was chapbook. It was with the Life and Times of Susie Knuckles, which is one of your aliases.
Yes,
but it is also very much about the Woo.
Yes, it's about Old Dirty Bastard and also a boy that broke my heart in college.
Right. Yeah, and that's the collection. And when I remember, Angel was working at the Greenlight Bookstore in Brooklyn, I think at the time. Mm-hmm. And this is a collection, a chapbook that came out. And she was telling me about you. And you were, I mean, when you first published that, you were how old?
I was 21. I was a few months from turning 22, I think.
Okay. And that collection blew my mind. But I was also just so amped that there was a writer in the world who would spend an entire collection writing. Exactly. Like, But I mean, because there is that time still where it's like the idea that there was going to be explicitly hip hop generation influenced poets was still like a relatively new thing. Mm. And so it was just like, I felt when Angel told me, and then when I read you, it just felt like kindred spirit, you know? The making of that collection came how? Because that was, to me, that was like a, I don't know if you think it's a big project, but it seemed like not only a beautiful project, but also kind of like introduced you to, in my estimation, a larger world. But how did that project come about?
It's very kind of you to say about my little college chapbook.
For real, but can I tell you, even today, I had a student text me asking me if they could borrow the copy.
It's out of print. I don't have a copy.
Yeah. Evidently, and my copy is on loan to another student. So I'm like, you got to get in line. Yeah,
I mean, if you lose it, I can send you the PDF. That's all I got for you.
I know, yo. Yeah. Reprint it.
The press went out of business. Is the thing. I think so mine and there was... Again? I don't know that I want to.
She got bars on deck. I mean, it's like, yeah.
Moving on.
You still
have models. I haven't looked at it in years, but I don't know that if I were to look at it now, I would like it on, like, a craft level because part of me is really happy that I have, like, the sheer luck that it went out of print so I don't have to deal with, like, my embarrassing young person poems.
Like, YouTube videos.
Yeah, so it can just be the lost files. I'm happy about that. At the time, I had been listening to a lot of Wu-Tang as a young person, but for some reason, I don't know why this came up, but around that time, I was just thinking a lot about Old Dirty Bastard. And I think I was thinking a lot about Old Dirty Bastard because I was thinking a lot about alter ego and self-naming and the performance of self and the idea of multiple selves as like a beautiful thing but also as a dangerous thing and as a carnivorous thing. At that point I'd been going to a lot of poetry slams, I'd been hanging out with a lot of artists, with a lot of musicians, with a lot of people who I knew so much of about their lives. I knew so many of their intimate secrets. I knew so much of their business because of the art that we were making. And I didn't know their real names, their given names, you know?
You mean they had stage names?
Yeah. So I knew a lot of people who I thought myself to be very close with, and I only knew them by their stage names. And I was also, I felt like I was seeing a lot of people, you know, like adopt personas and be consumed by those personas. And it wasn't, and not I'm not saying this with any judgment necessarily. I didn't think I thought positively or negatively of it. I just was fascinated by it because I didn't know that you could do that.
Mm-hmm.
I am drawn to like tragic geniuses. Old Dirty Bastard, Abdul Halim Hafiz, what have you.
Dirt was still alive when you were...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. I was in middle school when he died. My brother and I went to private school, and we were the only two people who knew that he was dead that day.
Right.
And the thing is, I make so much of my work out of that space of obsession that once I'm out of it, I can't tell you now that I've, like, exercised that particular corner of the obsession. I could not tell you where it came from. I just knew that it hit me, and I lived in it for years. I couldn't write about anything else, you know? I was writing about heartbreak, but also I was writing about ODB. I was writing about identity, but also I was writing about ODB.
Hmm.
What is, like, the connection or the fascination?
So the conceit of the book, as I remember it, because, again, I haven't seen that thing in years.
Yeah.
But Susie Knuckles started as a joke in that Childish Gambino had just started making music at the time, and so everyone was plugging their names into that Wu-Tang name generator. And I didn't like what the generator gave me. I thought the name it gave me was kind of stupid. But then I don't remember. But I remember being like, damn, I wanted something good. And I don't. And because I think it's the algorithm uses the letters of your name, it kept giving me the same one.
Mm-hmm.
So I was like, well, I'm just going to make my own. So I probably still have this somewhere, but I just had like a Word document of like fake joke aliases just because I thought it was funny.
Mm-hmm.
And I started writing these poems where this character of Susie Knuckles, who was like an alter ego, or who was almost like my conscience, or like a little person who sat on my shoulder and was like my like stronger self or whatever. But I started writing those poems as a joke because I was also at that time doing slam and was like sitting through all these trauma porn ass poems all day every day, and I was like, wow, poetry is not fun. Where all I'm doing is like getting on stage and picking my scabs and like telling people my business in a way that like a lot of it was stuff that I was over, but again, I was coached not well as a young poet. And so I was starting to think that the only stuff that was valuable in me was the stuff that hurt me.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, I don't want to keep writing poems like that. That was, if that was the trajectory, then I was going to be done writing poems in like a matter of months.
Yeah.
So to balance out all these like poems that I hated writing that I was practicing for college slam nationals, I also on the side was like writing these like poems that I thought were funny in the voice of this Susie Knuckles, you know?
Yeah.
So
Susie Knuckles was kind of like the lighter version of you.
Yeah. And so Susie Knuckles becomes a character in this book, and there, part of it is that my speaker was like going through this like fucked up heartbreak, whatever, and then Susie Knuckles was kind of telling me to like pull it together.
Yeah.
But then in being an alter ego, Susie Knuckles also engages with the character of ODB as sort of like a high priest of alter ego, as like the person who like introduced the idea of being able to be multiple selves in the first place.
Yeah.
So it was a weird little project. I don't know. I don't know what I was thinking, but.
But that obsession, that obsession that you took with that project absolutely informs your first collection, The January Children.
Yeah, it's the only way I know how to write books.
So
I have to like pick someone dead who I love and live in that obsession for a long time.
But I love that as a process, because I think I get obsessed with ideas, and I learned that from writers who paid a lot of attention to painters who would then be obsessed with the mood that they were in. That mood would produce a body of work that would result in the show, and then they would inevitably get in a different kind of mood.
Yeah.
So when you get obsessed in that way, so to produce a book like The January Children, you know, how long does that mood last, and what kind of you know, bunker research do you have to go in order to, you know, come out the other end with a collection?
Well, so I think the way I even learned the technique of like finding this, I guess muse is the word, but I'm not so interested in that word, but finding this figure that would then function as an avatar for all this other more nebulous stuff that I was contending with. When I was writing Susie Knuckles, I was really obsessed. I still am. It's one of my favorite projects, but I really love Rilke's Sonnets to Orpheus. And this idea that you can like spend multiple poems meditating on a figure who is not yourself. But who represents something to you that you then take into yourself and contemplate about yourself. And there were a lot of parallels for me at the time between ODB and Orpheus, and that was like a whole thing. I like wrote papers about it for school and stuff. It wasn't just for the book. It was like my whole life. But it almost feels like a cheat code for making a project in that, or it might even be that it's, I've come to depend too much on it, and that now it's very hard for me to make work if I'm not actively obsessed with something. But with the January Children, you know, the Abd al-Halim obsession came sort of out of nowhere. You know, I moved into the first apartment where I was living by myself with no roommates. I wasn't in a dorm. I wasn't whatever. It was the first time I'd been by myself, you know, and it was wild. I would go days without speaking out loud. And I got really homesick for the first time, where before that it wasn't, because it was so, I was so caught up in the excitement of finally moving to New York and all of that. And so I started reaching for all the stuff that I remembered from home, where I like went back to DC and I got like curtains from my mom's room and I put them up in my apartment, and I was like learning all of the recipes, and I finally like started to ask my grandma, how do you make this? How do you whatever? And then the music was just like a natural next step to make the whole space feel like what I remembered. But listening to Abd al-Halim in this new context, now that I was like American and had a vocabulary around blackness, had a vocabulary around race, was like a whole new experience, where it wasn't just pop music anymore. It wasn't just songs about love anymore. He was singing specifically to a darker girl. And, you know, at that point I was old enough to know what racism was. So I was old enough to know how radical that was. So the obsession, you know, it started there. And I was listening to him every day. I bought on Amazon, I bought the DVD of the biopic, and it took like 3 months to arrive in like a heavily, like an envelope that looked like it had passed through customs 17 times. And when it got there, it was just like a blank DVD cover, and someone had like printed out the picture of the movie poster, but it was really blurry and bad, and like slid it into the sleeve.
Oh, wow. Yeah. You know, in India, they have that. Oh, it's so great.
And I love it. I still have it, you know, and I would watch it several times a week. I could like recite whole portions of the dialogue.
And they don't even call them DVDs. They have like a whole other, like, you know, VHS, DVD, but there's like something else like, oh, that's just like bootleg as fuck.
I love it.
Yeah.
But so it was that, you know, and I would like would just be researching every way I could. And at first it was hard to do the research because I was looking for stuff just in English. And there's, you know, you look in English, there's like a Wikipedia page. There's my favorite bit of trivia, which is that Jay-Z's Big Pimpin', which is produced by Timbaland, samples Abd al-Halim's Khusara Khusara. But then I would, you know, I started interviewing people. I sat down with my grandma for like 2 hours and I recorded her. Because he was like the Elvis or the Frank Sinatra or the something of that time. She remembers where she was and what she was doing when she found out that he died. It was, you know, he was that big. There's the mythology is that on the day of his funeral, 14 women jumped off balconies and killed themselves because he was like this like national boyfriend. Everyone was in love with him. So, yeah, the book, it took work to write or whatever, but it almost like slipped out because it was like, what else was I going to be doing? I was so obsessed. It was the only thing I could think to be doing.
How long was the process, would you say, to compose?
The oldest poem in the book, I wrote my, I think, junior year of college. And the last poem in the book, I wrote a couple days before I had to turn in my grad school thesis. So overall, I would say about 3 or 4 years from start to finish.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
I mean, how did you... Yeah, I mean, the thing you said about figuring out blackness and navigating that, but you're also brown and you're also, you know, African, but you know, I mean...
Yeah.
I don't even know how to phrase a question. Like, how do you navigate that?
I'm still learning. I'm still learning what to call myself, you know? I think blackness, you know, despite, like, history and its hardships or whatever, was the easiest thing. It was the thing that no one questioned me on. Mm-hmm. So I got to America and like I smelled funny, I talked funny, but I said I was black and no one blinked.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
The thing with Sudan is in a really weird spot identity wise because Sudan is in Africa. A lot of people in Sudan look like me, but Sudan is, well, North Sudan now because it's two countries, is mostly Arabic speaking. And when people think of Arabs, they think of people who look a very specific way and they don't look like me. And when people think of Arabs, they don't think of blackness at all. Mm. So when I was in, and at that point, I'd mostly been in Arabic speaking spaces. And that was the first time I encountered racism. You know, I didn't really meet a white person until later on in my life. And in those spaces, I would be like, hey, me too. I also speak Arabic. And people would look at me funny. Mm. Or people would be like, wow, where'd you learn to speak like that? Or, you know, who taught you that? Or I didn't know they spoke Arabic in Sudan, or, you know, things like that. So blackness was always, it always felt like home in a way that so many of my other identities have, so much angst wrapped up in them. Mm-hmm. The question of Arabness, though, haunted me until, 2 hours ago. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Where, because I feel so in community with Arabs and Arabic-speaking people, because we share a language, and to a greater degree we share a vaguer idea of culture, you know? We grew up listening to the same music and eating mostly the same foods and all that stuff. So I'm, in that community, but I'm not of it, and there's always been that sort of weird tension around that. So mm-hmm. I'm, writing these poems about Abd al-Halim Hafiz, and, you know, an Arab will reach out to me and be like, wow, I also had this connection with Abd al-Halim Hafiz, but maybe if that Arab invited me over to dinner, their grandparent might call me a racial slur. So who's to say, you know?
I mean, it's just interesting because when I saw you perform in London, mm-hmm. I had never seen you perform before. And to be honest, I'd heard your name, but wasn't familiar with your work. But, you know, I'm Indian, so, but hearing you talk about a lot of this stuff, you know, there's the parallel.
Yeah.
Which is just I don't know. To me, it's always just I've not been surrounded by a lot of first generation creative people. Yeah. So when I hear that, it was just really beautiful.
Yeah. You know? I'm also always really excited when I meet a first generation creative person, because we defeated all the odds of trying to become doctors and lawyers and found a way to still make art.
I mean, the support you got was great. I got no support, so, you know.
I mean, every now and then I'll still have a relative be like, hey, it's not too late to go to law school.
Right.
Well, your life now is I mean, that of the artist, right?
It's
weird
as hell.
Right. So what I mean, because in part, I mean, the book also kind of changed your life. Mm. It opened up a lot of spaces for you to be a full-time artist. You know, the day-to-day of that now, what does it look like for you in terms of some of the mundane things, but also in terms of the maintenance of a practice?
Well, so my life there's so much about my life that doesn't look the same week to week, where the one constant for the past 3 years is that I'm never home, you know? And as a result, for the first year and a half of touring, because touring at first, you know, it's travel, so it feels like vacation. You're like, well, my real life and my obligations and my habits and all that, I leave that at home. And when I'm on the road, I don't have to exercise. I can eat chicken nuggets at every meal. Mm-hmm. And I'll do my writing and all that stuff when I get back home. And then, you know, you look up and you haven't been back home in a matter of months. And it's like, well, when am I ever going to exercise and stop eating chicken nuggets and write a poem? So now I'm trying to make sure that my life on the road has some semblance of what I want my home life to look like, even though my life on the road is my home life. When I'm at home, I sleep for 3 days. I do 17 pounds of laundry and I watch a lot of television. So that has turned into the vacation now.
Wild.
Yeah. Yeah. And your writing, what are you working on right now? Are you working on, do you feel like you're working on another book?
I am.
Yeah. Okay.
So I, a few weeks ago, spent a week at a residency, and finally got out the beginnings of a first draft of a book that's been knocking around in my head for, I only just recognized it as a book right towards the end of last year, but some of the pieces that fit in had been a little bit older than that. But I'm working on a book length poem, and it's going very slowly because I'm trying to teach myself the form as I do it.
What is a book length poem for?
So it's just one long poem. Yeah. But, and again, I'm still learning the form, so I'm simultaneously, while I'm trying to make my own, I'm reading ones that other people have written.
What about it is specific?
So the ones I've liked best it feels like the whole thing as a whole feels kind of like a movie, and that start to finish you like went on a journey in like kind of an unbroken line. But the ones that I've really loved have been ones where you could like open a page and that part can function as a poem on its own out of context. So it like, it's not entirely one thread. I think I'm trying to right now braid together a bunch of different things that will feel cohesive as a whole, but also like, if I want to like take out one piece and read that at a reading and not have to make people sit through an entire book length poem every time I read, I want it to be able to work out of context as its own like little chapter of the whole. So it's going very slowly.
Yeah,
a lot of it is bad, but
it's always like that in the beginning.
Yeah. But it helps to have it like in front of me on a piece of paper where I can look at it and figure out why it's bad, instead of it just being this idea that I've been like every day I wake up and be like, don't forget, I'll write it down tomorrow, and then like it had been like that for months. So ODB came back a little bit in it.
It's exciting.
Only in spirit, in that the book / the poem is called Girls That Never Die. And it's from, you know, his verse in Ghetto Superstar by Praz and Maya, where he says, I'm hanging out partying with girls, break, that never die. I hear it without the break, so I'm hanging out partying with girls that never die. So I'm thinking about what it would be like to be in this world, in this body, in this identity as a black woman, as a Muslim woman, as a woman, sort of every day that I navigate all the like the danger that's like imagined and enacted against me, and what that story would look like and what that world would feel like if it was repopulated with girls that never die. Because I'm thinking about shame a lot these days, and how I've been so governed by shame, and how so much of my relationship to, you know, body and culture and religion and language and all that is so rooted in shame and is so governed by shame. So how the way to, because the thing, the way that shame like maintains its governance is with the threat of danger, is that if you do this, if you do wrong, if you like dishonor your family, if you dishonor your culture, if you commit a sin, if you whatever, someone's gonna kill you. So, but what if I can't die? Then what, I've deactivated shame. I've defused shame.
You say a lot of things that are like in my brain, but I don't know.
That's why you guys are homies.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. Well, that's exciting and beautiful and yeah.
It's gonna take a long time. Exciting. A lot of it is bad right now, but
yeah. Yeah. But
you
that's
know,
yeah.
Stay tuned.
Yeah, that's great.
Look out for the Google Docs link.
I literally cannot wait. You know, when I know part of your practice is also just the maintenance of self. You know, I really, you know, when we were, you know, in Europe traveling, in part to kind of make this inquiry into international version of the breakbeat poets, and part of what I really admired about, you know, you was just the time you took for yourself. But I also know that requires a lot of different things. But what are some of the things that you do for yourself in order to maintain a life on the road, in artistic practice? What's some of the ways that you just really care for yourself?
I take so many naps. I do so many face masks. Yeah. Those are the, you know, if there would be like a holy trinity, it would be like naps, face masks, and the Food Network.
You do, yeah. You do watch a lot of Food Network.
I watch a lot of Food Network.
yeah. I love the Food Network. You have Chopped is your favorite show, or?
I love Chopped, but the thing, it depends on where I'm at, because Chopped is when I'm actually trying to watch something, because you really get emotionally invested in Chopped. But sometimes, you know, I like a nice background Diners, Drive-Ins, and Dives while I answer emails, sir.
Yeah, because you can't really pay too much.
You don't want to pay too much attention because it starts to grate at you a little bit. Yeah. But in the background on low volume, you're like, oh, that looks good. Like, back to what I was doing.
I would eat that.
Yeah. So it's nice to like look up occasionally and note. But occasionally on the late night, there'll be a Beat Bobby Flay marathon, which is a good look. I like Iron Chef. Top Chef isn't on Food Network. It's on Lifetime, I believe, but I like Top Chef a lot. It's nice. It's just like so much. I have a hard time being a person, you know what I mean? And it like, I feel like a newborn most of the day, where everything, like, colors are so bright and noises are so loud and people are so people, and, like, you know, I'm so overstimulated the entire day, and I feel like I feel everything at, like times a thousand more than, like, what is appropriate. So sometimes the ways that I need to take care of myself is I need to sit down and watch something that I'm not invested in, to just, like, turn the volume down and be, like, not so stimulated, because I spend so much of the day, like, being so stimulated.
And is that an awareness, like, is that just the awareness of a poet, or is that, but
I think I'm just a weird person, Kevin.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, there's like alien shit that's happening.
Maybe, I don't know. I've hide a lot inside, so.
Yeah. I don't know that it, I think actually it, like, gets in the way of being a poet, is the thing, where, like, I think I feel like I'm doing the thing I want to do as a poet when I can, like, really, like, hone in on the thing and, like, block out all the noise and just zoom in on, like, the one thing that I'm considering. And that's not what my life is at all, usually. Usually I'm like, here's the thing I'm experiencing here, but also in my periphery there's, like, all these bright colors and noises, and also these people, and also someone just touched my hand, and also, you know what I mean? I can't write like that. So
I just feel like writers are really observant. So, you know, those things are just, like, on, like, more extreme.
Yeah, it's exhausting.
Yeah.
So I watch a lot of Food Network. and I think also when I actually, like, get down to the act of writing, again, so much of that is, like, in, like, putting blinkers on, almost. So I'll, the one constant almost my entire life as a writer is that when I'm writing, I'll listen to the same song or piece of music or whatever on repeat until I'm done, because it helps me feel outside of time.
The, like, same singular song?
Same singular song.
Same song,
yeah,
every
writer? Yeah, it just repeats for as long as it takes.
But, like, is it one song that you've always listened to, or do
you flip out
the song?
It depends on, like, what I'm on at the moment. Okay. It used to be, earlier on, I could only listen to instrumentals. I couldn't listen to stuff that had words in it. But now, there are no rules, you know.
What's your joint right now?
Right now, well, I mean, here's the part where I confess that I haven't written a poem in about a month and a half.
Since the residency?
Yeah. But when I was at the residency, there is an old Sudanese song, which is, I don't know whose song it is originally. It's one of those songs, like,
almost,
what's an example?
It's a folk song that becomes,
almost a folk song. You know, yeah. I was trying to think of an example in, like, American pop music, but it's one of those songs that every single person has covered. It's just one of those things, like, you know, it's almost like a rite of passage. If you want to be a singer, you gotta cover that song. It's called Ya Habibi Ana Ayan. So I found this video on YouTube. The singer is very young, and there's some parts that are, like, not so good, but it's really beautiful. And it's a cappella. He's, like, at an open mic or something. And so I hit that, like, YouTube to mp3.net or whatever, and I now have it on my computer, and I would just listen to that, because there, it, I think I spend a lot of my self-soothing time trying to feel less so I can focus, but I think something about this, like, it makes me feel a lot. It makes me really emotional because he's trying so hard, and, like, sometimes it's really beautiful and sometimes it's really not. And that, I think, like, opened me up in a way that I needed to sort of get to the place I need to be in to write these, like, weirdly personal poems after, like, years of, like, writing more generally about, like, the failure of the nation state and stuff that, like, redirected the gaze away from my body. Now it's just, like, so about my body that I'm freaking out. And so to, like, watch this person, like, attempt and fail and sometimes succeed was, like, it's helpful to me.
Yeah.
And then after a while, the thing is, after, like, the third, fourth listen, it kind of fades into the background and it's
and you're in it. Yeah.
Oh, she's in the same song over and over again.
Yeah.
I feel like somebody else just told me that, like, Tisha or something.
Yeah, I don't know.
It helps because after a set, it becomes white noise after, like, 5 minutes.
Right. I feel like I just need silence.
Yeah.
I can't, because the thing is, I can't, there is no such thing as silence. When it's really quiet, then I'm like, there's a bird outside the window, and also traffic, and, like,
facts. Well, yo, you've dropped many gems. If you could put us on to maybe, like, your, you know, top five in whatever capacity you might want to answer that question. Yeah,
yeah,
kind of
can
across
I give you a cross genre.
Please,
top five?
Yeah, actually, yeah, all, the more the better. Yeah.
We got your Holy Trinity. Is that included? Is that
yeah? Food Network, Face Mask, Black Thought, Ann Carson, Abdul Halim Hafiz, Andre 3000, Kamal Brathwaite.
Yeah.
We should do across the board.
Yeah, cross genres, top five. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, no, that was fire.
Thank you.
And where can people stay in tune with you on the interconnected networks?
So my website is safia-mafia.com. My Instagram is at Safia Mafia. My Twitter is at Mafia Safia because the other one was taken, and that person never tweets.
Man.
But it's too late.
Could we contact Twitter? Or?
I thought about it, but you know, it's been years
good.
At this point.
Let it ride. Yeah.
You know. But sometimes I'll just go like search the page just to see if they've tweeted yet. As of yet.
Still. Ghost. Yeah.
So yeah, Safia Mafia on Instagram, Mafia Safia on Twitter. Yeah, that's about it. I've forgotten my Facebook password, so that's not so useful. but
that's fair.
Stuck in a time now.
Yeah.
Well, we love having you in the corner store. We love having you in Chicago.
It's good to be here.
So more of that. We hope we'll make that happen.
I'm telling you, LASIK dental insurance.
Say less.
Give her that. You better give
say
her
less.
Want me to stay?
Well, yo, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Yo, we want to thank DJ Exist for the beat.
Langston Olsen for the art.
Big ups, Todd Manley at WGN Radio.
And Max and Dami, the Corner Store interns.
Salutes to our super producer, DJ Cash Era.
You can keep in tune with the Corner Store at cornerstore_pod on Instagram, Twitter, and SoundCloud.
Also, you can stream and download the Corner Store wherever you listen to podcasts.
And please rate and subscribe and comment on iTunes.
Please, y'all, consider giving us those 5 stars.
Thank you for listening.
We're going to see you next week.